I keep losing my speaking notes. I'm falling apart on you as I stand here. Look, we are now, unfortunately, 10 minutes behind, so I'm berating myself vigorously up here. We will move on fairly quickly. We've got two presentations coming up, followed by a panel that will get us through to lunchtime, focusing on core network issues. I'm going to call each of the speakers up individually and then we'll get the panel up. Before I do that though, there's a couple of other housekeeping pieces I need to announce. The first is that the slides from yesterday's presentations are available on the Commerce Commission website. I believe if you go to the comcom.gov.nz website and go to Media Events, you will find those presentations, and presumably today's will be available tomorrow. The other thing is that those people who are in the webcast obviously can't write on sticky pieces of paper and stick them on my wall, but we'd still value any thoughts and contributions you have on the question, what needs to be different if New Zealand is going to lead the world in NGN development. And if you just send them in to the NGN email address, ngn@comcom.gov.nz, we'll be able to gather those together for at least a sort of piece of work about a post-conference summary document. We won't quite call it a communique because that's getting a bit too severe. So without further ado, let's get underway on the discussion of core network issues. And our first keynote speaker on this subject is Scott Marcus, who's already participated vigorously in our conversation. But bottom line, without going into further detail, is that Scott is extremely experienced in this field, having been involved in many activities and written in many places. But most specifically at the moment comes to us as a senior consultant from Vic, the consulting company in Germany. So could you please welcome Scott Marcus to the podium on IP interconnection.
Thank you very much. It's really a tremendous pleasure to be here. I'm very grateful to the Commerce Commission for inviting me. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, what we're going to be talking about today is interconnection as networks evolve to Internet Protocol, to IP. And there are a number of things that we'll be covering in the course of doing that. What makes an IP network different? Really, how is IP interconnection done? How is network interconnection done in the traditional switch network? How does one approach the topic of quality of service? I'll be speaking briefly toward the end about transition issues and making a couple of concluding remarks to try to pull it together for you. Now, Einstein once said that everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. I'll be trying to break this down as much as I can into bite-sized bits. But you should realize in advance it is a very complicated topical area. It draws not only on engineering, on economics, also on many public policy issues and a bit on business. So all of these get sort of mixed together in complicated ways. I'll try to break it down, but please bear with me. Also, there's a lot of material to cover in a fairly limited time. So with that said, what happens in an IP-based world, in an Internet Protocol world? We've heard about this a lot over the past couple of days. This is basically what, to an engineer, an Internet Protocol world looks like. And one of the key characteristics of it is precisely that you have, let's say you're sitting in your personal computer trying to do some browsing from a web server. It's basically the web browser in your personal computer talking to the web server. It's an application-to-application dialogue that in some sense has relatively little to do with the underlying networks. This sort of principle of separation into layers in a network is one of the great breakthroughs of the TCP/IP protocol. The way it's done is that the services request services from progressively lower layers. The traffic travels through the network through multiple routers, forwarding engines. But the genius of this is precisely that the applications don't have to know much about the network, and the network doesn't have to know much about the applications. And the reason why I belabor the point is that it has policy implications. This technical property is the reason why you have the ability for any application to run over any set of transmission facilities. It's why you can have multiple applications running in a single device. It's why you can have multiple applications running over a single network transmission link. Now, why do we care? Well, it's because it implies changes As we've heard repeatedly over the past couple of days, changes in the value chain, and those changes in the values in the value chain imply profound changes in the nature and character of competition. It means that you've got different kinds of networks competing with each other. It means that you've got competition on a multiple play services basis. It means that you have competition between service providers that might not even have a network. Think Skype, think the US provider Vonage, IP voice providers that aren't network providers. Now, as regulators, we care a lot about this, and I tend to hang out more with regulators than anybody else. Regulation is there basically to deal with those things that the competitive market doesn't deal with by itself. A lot of those have to do with market power problems, competitive bottlenecks, the pinch points we've been hearing about repeatedly. Some of them have to do with things that the market by itself might not deliver, so-called public goods problems. And a third area of issue has to do with allocation of certain scarce resources, the resources, societal resources, numbers, spectrum. So all of these changes in the character of the value chain and in the character of competition have implications for regulators. And at the moment, actually, the jury is still to a significant degree out as to whether the competitive problems will be better, worse, or about the same in the NGN world. Some of the bottlenecks clearly don't go away. Some actually might be improved by the fact that you have intermodal competition, less of a possibility here, of course, because you don't have cable in New Zealand, but still. Some of the new forms of competition might make the regulator's job easier, but some other bottlenecks are likely to remain, and there might actually be new bottlenecks that emerge, especially in the upper layers of the network. Now, when we talk about interconnection with all of this said, you've got the IP world, especially the internet world, which has worked quite well without regulation historically. You've got the traditional switch network world, the PSTN, and also the mobile network, in those, you don't have examples of networks that operate without some form of regulation. So one naturally begins by asking, how are these environments different? Why are they different? What can we learn by comparing them? And this is a problem and a question that's occupied many countries and many parts of the world over the last few years. I've been engaged in studies not only for the International Telecommunications Union and the European Commission, but also for multiple national governments. Okay, so let's talk a little about IP interconnection. IP interconnection is dealt with mainly through two techniques called peering and transit. There are a few more exotic variants of them, but those two really are enough to explain what's happening. And in general, a system that has operated based on peering without regulation has been pretty satisfactory for regulators and stakeholders around the world, I would claim. There have been exceptions. One of the best known is relatively close to here in Australia a few years back. But and I look significantly at our chair here, yes. But basically, taken as a whole, the system has worked pretty darn well, surprisingly well, perhaps, without regulation. Now, the best definitions of peering and transit that I've seen came from a study group that reported to the U.S. Federal Communications Commission a few years back, the so-called NRIC, or Network Reliability Advisory. I forget the name acronym, sorry. Okay. And I was actually on this panel. Embarrassing. Okay. So there we go. Time flies. But basically, describes peering as a bilateral relationship between providers where they exchange traffic just for their own customers and implicitly also for customers of their customers. It's solely a bilateral traffic exchange of their respective traffic, not for third parties. Transit includes third-party traffic exchange, usually means traffic exchange to the whole world. You know, in a certain sense, the broadband service that you might have at home is a transit service. It carries your internet traffic everywhere. So how do these work? Well, you know, basically, providers, unless you're one of the very biggest providers, normally your traffic is being transited by someone else. You provide your traffic to a somewhat larger provider. Part of the reason why the whole system works at an economic level at all is due to a property known as statistical multiplexing, which is that the pipe that you need to send the traffic upstream can be smaller than the sum of pipes here, the sum of pipes coming in, because you recognize that not everybody will be sending the maximum they could at the same time. The traffic sort of folds together in ways that provide efficiency. Now, what's peering then? Well, think about two providers. Think about the two little guys. This is not the only reason why it happens, but it's one reason why people peer. Why would they choose to peer? And the answer is simply, if establishing a connection between them costs less, than the amount they save by having less traffic that has to go upstream to be carried to the rest of the world. Then it's profitable for them to peer. It's pure economic optimization. Now, the combination of peering and transit collectively provide access everywhere. What it means essentially is any given bit of traffic going from, let's say, here to there goes through at most one peering connection, because remember, the peering connections really provide traffic only to customers and customers of customers of those two respective networks. So you get sort of a hierarchical system. It concentrates, but it doesn't have to concentrate up to just a single point. This is the way the system works. The peering arrangements are done by negotiation between the parties. Frequently, there are agreements to do this without charge. Not always. When I was in industry, and I spent many years actually as a chief technology officer for one of the largest internet backbones in the world, frequently there will be some charges associated with it, especially if the networks don't view themselves as having equal exchange of value. But also, more often than not, it'll be without charge. Now, if we look instead at the switched world, you've got a very extensive economics literature that's developed over the past 10 years. You've got linkages between that literature, but not so many, to the literature also in the economics articles for IP interconnection. And before we delve in, let me say, it's really important to distinguish in these between the retail arrangements to the end user, the customer, versus the wholesale arrangements between the companies. They very often get confused, especially in trade press level articles. So we'll try to keep them crisp here. Now, at retail, what happens? The most common arrangement is something called calling party pays. And in that, the party that places a telephone call, and here we're really talking about the voice world, the party that places the call pays for the call. The party that receives the call typically doesn't pay anything. That's the system that we all recognize. It's well known. It's been around for a long time. It's used in most of the world. There have been other systems that have existed. One that shows up a lot in the literature, and I would say perhaps too much in the literature, is receiving party pays. It was used in the U.S. mobile industry up until about 10 years ago. It's really hard to find one of these systems today. It's there simply, I think, for completeness of discussion. We don't need to dwell on it. The main alternative to the calling party pays model are various forms of flat rate plans at retail. And basically, these are the ones that most customers want, I would contend. They're essentially a plan where you pay a certain amount per month, either for, in the case of fixed network, often unlimited traffic. For mobile network, it's usually a sort of banded plan where you have a fixed price per month for up to some number of minutes of traffic. And these plans tend to be very popular. In the U.S. market, something like 80-85% of the market is banded flat rate plans or buckets of minutes plans. Those are the main arrangements at retail level. Now, wholesale level, you have two basic ways that it's done. The one that's done through pretty much all the world is called calling party network pays. Many people sort of lump this together with calling party pays. They're not the same thing. This is wholesale level. And we'll come to a picture in just a second of what it means. It's a payment between the networks, not between the user and the network. The main alternative to this is a system used in the United States called bill and keep. It's also used in a few other countries, Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, in varying degrees. No country that I know of uses bill and keep for everything. It's used selectively where it's used. So, on to calling party network pays. What does it look like? Well, this is sort of what it looks like. The network, let's say this caller is placing a call to that caller. The network of the party placing the call makes a payment to the network of the party that receives the call, the terminating network. And that payment is called a termination fee. The rate at which it's paid is the termination rate. Now, it made some sense, and makes some sense, in a world where you have calling party pays retail. The rationale being, this network is getting a retail payment from its customer. This network wouldn't get a retail payment from its customer because, remember, in calling party pays, the receiving party doesn't pay. So instead, you have a wholesale payment, and that's the way that the terminating network gets compensated for its part of call completion. You know, that's really the historic model. That's the way it's done in varying degrees really everywhere. Now, there are some issues with calling party network pays, or CPNP. The most important is that there's no way to bypass the terminating network. In general, for a given telephone number, there's only one network that can complete the call to that number. And that confers a certain form of market power on the terminating network. And that's referred to as the terminating monopoly. Now, there's a lot of economic literature on this. The short story is, because there's market power for termination, the termination prices would tend to be set, absent regulation, at levels much higher than the ones that are socially efficient. There's some variance between how it would be done for mobile and fixed. There's a lot of fine detail in the economic literature, but basically the prices would tend by default to be too high. And it also creates arguably some economic distortions as well if they're too high, if they're higher than real cost. It tends to distort the development of the mobile network relative to the fixed. So there's some concerns, and they're normally addressed and partly corrected through regulation. Now, the alternative model that's used in the U.S. Is referred to as bill and keep. And it has a couple of flavors. Probably the most relevant to this discussion is something called reciprocal compensation. If you talk to most American experts, they'll say, it's great here, we don't regulate it. If you look more deeply at it, that's not correct. In fact, it's highly regulated, but it's regulated in a different way. It's regulated through complex and rather poorly understood rules on symmetry or reciprocity between traffic, between the operators. I'll put up a table. I won't explain it because I think it would take far too long than we want to take. But suffice to say that calls made to an incumbent are charged at rates that are at most the regulated cost of the incumbent. Calls made to a competitor are actually limited through sort of parity provisions to the cost of the incumbent unless the competitor wants to prove that they have a higher cost. Between, say, mobile operators or between non-dominant local carriers, the rates could in principle be anything. They're usually set to zero, and that's actually a good property. Part of the reason why they're low is because of the symmetry obligations or reciprocity obligations. There can't be a big difference here between the mobile termination rate and the fixed rate. That's prevented by the reciprocity requirements. And so, essentially, there's no reason to set them high as there are in other countries. Okay, so what do we know about how these systems work? Well, systems that have lower zero rates, as exists in the U.S., those don't set any restrictions on the retail plans. The retail plans can be anything. They can be calling party pays, they can be flat rate, they can be anything. And also, what you get in such countries are flat rate plans that usually include pretty much all domestic calls. In countries that have calling party network pays, and particularly where termination rates are, let's say, relatively high, call it 10 euro cent, whatever, per minute. In those countries, generally speaking, the termination rate sets a floor on the price. And the reason is that that termination fee is something that has to be paid by the operator that is responsible for the customer that placed the call. That means it's a wholesale cost. Since it's a cost at wholesale, there's a tendency not to set the retail price less than the cost. So it influences retail price. Now, how do those retail prices, how do they affect consumers? What happens with the consumer? Well, this is a set of data that I like to show. It comes from Merrill Lynch, from their quarterly wireless matrix. Happily, this particular set of data is publicly available for free. Most of the report you have to pay for. These happen to be free every year. They're published in a competition report from the U.S. Federal Communications Commission. And what do the numbers here mean? Well, the left axis is the so-called service-based revenue per minute of use. So if you take all the retail revenues coming into the company, and also all the wholesale termination revenues, but not equipment revenues. Therefore, handset costs, handset subsidies are not embedded. It's just the retail and wholesale revenue for the service itself. Divide that by the minutes. That's what this is. Now, the reason it's useful for a graph like this is that it's a pretty good proxy for average retail price on a normalized basis. And this, by the way, is in US dollars. So, you know, think of it. if you try to compare retail price between different plans, normally it's a mess. You've got many different plans. You don't know how many people have each plan. You don't know how each user uses each plan, their introductory offers, there's this, there's that. For an economist, it's a headache. In this case, all of that is effectively already factored into the total revenues. So it makes a reasonably good basis for comparison. There are some anomalies in the data. You have to know how to deal with them. But for a wave of the hand discussion like this, these are good enough. And what you see is, if you compare the minutes of use per month to the service-based revenue per minute, you see a downward sloping curve. Now, anybody who's had training in economics looks at this downward sloping curve and they immediately think of demand elasticity. This is not exactly that, but it's pretty close to that. What demand elasticity tells us is when things are more expensive, we tend to buy less of them. When they're less expensive, we may buy more of them if we want them. And what you see here is in countries that have really low service-based revenue per minute, effectively low average price, like we see on the left, like the United States, for example, you tend to get an awful lot of minutes consumed. And conversely, in countries like Germany, where I live, if you got really high price per minute, you tend to have very low usage. And it's not a small difference, it's a huge difference. The actual average usage in the United States is 8 times higher than in Germany. Now, one might think that the countries that have higher prices are making more money. They might possibly be making more profit. The operators there might be making more profit. Or they might not. If you look at ARPU, remember calculus 101. You're multiplying here the minutes of use times the service-based revenue. And so the ARPU is simply the product of the two. It's the area under the rectangle. So you can see the US ARPU, it's a pretty big rectangle. Even though the price per minute is low, it's a lot of minutes. And conversely, a country like Germany is a long, low rectangle that doesn't enclose much area. So the ARPU is actually about 2.5 times higher in the US, even though the price is much lower, 4 times lower. Okay, so is this rational behavior for the German operators? You could probably argue it either way. You have to know what their costs are to actually know what the profits are. Okay, so that's the characteristics in the retail market and how these things interact. Now, as you might gather, I have a certain perspective towards termination rates. In fact, one might even think of me as being sort of the terminator, or perhaps the anti-terminator. I tend to be a fan of lower termination rates because the rates tend to jack up the retail prices. So what do we know here? Well, kind of wrapping up this bit of the discussion, CPNP systems tend to lead to high termination rates, and the high termination rates tend to lead to high usage-based retail prices, per minute retail prices. They tend to lead to exclusions from flat rate plans. The calls that have high termination rates associated with them are the ones that normally aren't covered in the flat rate plans. It tends to lead to low willingness to place calls. People are happy to receive calls, but nobody wants to make them. It tends to actually lead to reduced average revenue per user, reduced gross revenue. Now, it has other factors as well. These are a little more complex. The fact that you have these disparities tends to lend itself to big price differences at retail between on-net calls and off-net calls. And those differences actually have a tendency to prevent competitors from pricing aggressively, some tendency, therefore, to soften competition. Arguably, the whole process also has a tendency to, again, somewhat distort the relative development of fixed versus mobile markets. There's also some positive effects, which I wouldn't want to understate, and that is that the higher termination rates tend to stimulate higher penetration, or at least more rapid penetration of mobile phones. Essentially, the operators, because the calls are highly profitable, they're more willing to provide handset subsidies, low monthly charges, low initial charges, and therefore you tend to get a faster adoption of mobile services. There may possibly be some negative impact on the fixed network. Oddly enough, I don't know of anybody that's rigorously studied that, but be that as it may, I would say that the balance of data is that it leads to faster penetration of the mobile service. There's actually a few papers that question that, but I think the balance of opinion is pretty strong on that point. So CPNP. Obviously, I'm sort of a fan of lower rates, not necessarily zero rates, but lower rates, even in the current system. And apologies if I'm going too fast, but I really have a short time slot here. So in the current world, this whole calling party network pays rests on a number of assumptions. It rests on, first, the assumption that the network is basically there to carry voice in the first place. Implicitly, it rests on the notion that the retail service is being provided by the same entity that's also the wholesale network operator, or at least somehow that they're closely linked and that the costs flow through. It also rests tacitly on the assumption that there's a big difference between placing a call and receiving a call. And basically, all of those come into question when you move to NGN. Essentially, what you have here is an effort to correct retail payment patterns through stuff happening at the wholesale level. Now, when you move to NGN, what happens? Well, first off, that termination monopoly doesn't go away. You've still got one phone number. You've still got one company that can complete calls to that one phone number. Secondly, you've got a world where voice is only a small fraction of total traffic. If you remember Paul's presentation yesterday, basically his data shows it quite clearly, and we all know this. Voice is a low bandwidth service compared to video, compared to a lot of other things. Second point, service provider might not be the network operator. Think about Skype. Think about US services like Vonage. Think about other third-party voice over IP services. Third, the whole question of who originates and who terminates a service in the internet, it's largely arbitrary. It's very easy to reverse. Even in the switched network, we've had refile systems where the direction is intentionally reversed to capitalize on pricing asymmetries. In the internet, it's even more arbitrary. That's the one bell. Good. Thank you. Ding. Okay, so what fraction of network traffic is voice? Well, this is a reputable study that Cisco did about a year and a half ago. And now, this is internet traffic, maybe not the same thing as mobile or fixed network traffic, but it's, I think, indicative. And which line is the IP voice line? Well, it's actually this skinny little green line in the middle there. And you'll note that as a fraction of at least internet traffic, it's tiny. It's really tiny. Video is potentially much larger. Peer-to-peer traffic is potentially much larger. Lots of things are much larger. It's a pretty small fraction of traffic. The idea that one should somehow try to recapture the cost of the network through the voice retail service, I think, starts to break down in this kind of world. Okay. On for a quick discussion of quality of service. And first off, not every application needs quality of service. Bidirectional voice definitely needs quality of service. Most studies, and this has been looked at for a long time, they say that you don't want to have more than about 150 milliseconds of delay end-to-end in a voice service over a network. Otherwise, you start both trying to talk at once. It's like satellite telephony. Okay, email doesn't need special handling. Video, it actually depends a lot on what you're doing with the video. If it's something like video on demand and you're willing to buffer things up for a few extra seconds at the beginning, then you really don't need special handling for quality of service. A little bit of a jitter buffer is all you need. If you're trying to do, as one of our speakers said yesterday, if you're trying to do heart surgery over the internet, then you absolutely do need rigorous controls. And also for two-way video conferencing, you would want rigorous video controls, quality controls. Okay, so quality of service technology has been around for a long time. It's been mature for at least 10 years. It was certainly mature when I was working in the industry up to 2001. It's been widely implemented inside of networks. You know, why isn't there quality of service implemented between networks? It wasn't the technology, obviously. It's everything else. Well, the first point is, how much do you really need it? Now, this is sort of standard queuing theory 101. It's the mathematics of waiting lines. And basically, the amount of time that it takes a packet to get through a single link is a function of how big the link is, what the variability of the length distribution of the packets is, a few other factors. It's standard mathematics for this stuff. And what it tells you is that for, let's say, this curve being the most representative of internet traffic, about a 1.2, what's called coefficient of variation, gives you about 150 microseconds of delay, even on a network that's 90% loaded. Now, running a network at 90% during busy hour, and by the way, internet designers do design for busy hour, running a network 90% load is probably the upper end of what anybody would ever want to do. And so that says is your delay per link, even on a relatively slow core link, this is 155 megabits per second, is only about a thousandth of your end-to-end budget for voice over IP. And the reason that's important is it tells us exactly what we already know intuitively, which is most of the time voice over IP performs pretty darn well. You use Skype, you use one of these services, I use them all the time. Most of the time they work pretty darn well, which means that the customer doesn't necessarily perceive a difference with managed quality of service, which means that they're not necessarily willing to pay a big premium to have it. But there are other reasons why you don't see deployment either. A second one, there's a whole published literature on industries that have network externalities, network effects. This is where the network is more valuable as there are more people on it. And those kind of networks have difficulty deploying new things, especially if they're long value chains, vertically related segments, and also where there's high transaction costs. Here the issue is, the service is of limited use as a cross-network service unless you can reach most people with it. If you just connect two networks together, it has only limited incremental value. And there's a transaction cost associated with each additional firm that you bring into play. So even though it's not that expensive to implement, it doesn't happen. The value proposition isn't there for the companies to do it. Now, network neutrality is closely linked to this whole QoS discussion. And this is a debate about quality of service, how it should be charged for, whether there's a risk that it would be done on an anti-competitive basis. Quality discrimination, we experience it all the time. We buy first class and second class airline tickets. In competitive markets, quality discrimination is not a problem. In markets where there's market power, quality discrimination could be a problem, can be used to exploit market power. So my contention is really that the debate about network neutrality is much more a debate about market power than about quality discrimination per se. The thing that really set it off in the U.S. was this quote from Ed Whitaker, who is president of what now is AT&T, saying that he doesn't want Google and Vonage to use his pipes for free. I ain't going to let them do that because we have spent this capital and we have to have a return on it. This shows why we should all aspire to be the CEO of a major U.S. corporation. You don't have to be terribly logical, and you don't even have to use correct English. Okay, but anyway, so my contention would be that the reason you have the headache in the U.S. is because they've allowed their markets to collapse into effectively a duopoly. Yes, they have competition with cable. No, they don't have any other competition. The average American has two choices, two period, not more. Not more realistic competitive options. In Europe, it's very much a different discussion, a much less intense, a much less raucous discussion, because the markets are much more robustly competitive and the regulatory tool bag is much more full of useful things. Okay, I'm on my last one or two, so here we go. Perfect, thank you. Almost perfect. Okay, so transition issues, there have been a bunch of issues. Last mile competition issues show up every place that's been doing NGN transitions. And actually, I would agree with the comments from the last panel that nobody's got a magic bullet and that the question what best practice is not fully settled. Different countries are doing it different ways. The changes in points of interconnection have been a point of contention every place. And the whole question of how to deal with changes in the cost structure has been an issue pretty much every place that has looked at this kind of transition. Partly because it's not only that the cost structure changes, it's also that you have periods of parallel operation during the transition where the costs might actually go up at an operational level because you're operating two networks in parallel. Now, as far as the transition in New Zealand, I had the great pleasure of meeting with the TCF IP working party a couple of days ago, and I would actually say that I'm cautiously quite optimistic about the things that are happening here. In a lot of countries, what I see is sort of hopeless deadlock and stonewalling between the market players. Here I see a much more proactive and constructive engagement between parties. I think this is actually a very good thing. There are enormous challenges. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's some things that, in my judgment, haven't even been addressed yet. But I would paint quite an optimistic picture of what I see. More than that, I really don't want to say because I have confidentiality obligations to the players. Okay, so concluding thoughts. Regulation of IP data hasn't been necessary in the past, probably won't be much necessary going forward. Regulation of voice services, until and unless something happens with the termination monopoly, some kind of regulatory intervention likely to still be needed. Longer term, it's not really clear that these non-zero termination rates are going to be sustainable, and what we've advocated repeatedly is that they need to work their way down to levels that are at most based on true marginal costs associated solely with the voice service. Sorry for running a little over.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Scott. Look, we're not going to do any question and answer with Scott right now. We are moving into a panel in a moment. So if you would kindly, once again, thank Scott for his contribution. But if you do have questions, we're going to ask them during the panel.